Welcome to the Theopolis Podcast. I'm Peter Lightheart, and I'm here today with Jeff Myers, Alistair Roberts, and James Bijan. Brian Motes is our technical assistant recording the podcast, and he'll be editing and putting everything out for you. Thank you for joining us in our podcast. We appreciate you following us and listening to our work. We hope that it's beneficial and helpful to you. We've been going for a number of months, I guess a year. I think we reached our year anniversary, maybe with the last podcast, through the book of Deuteronomy, inching our way through a section of Deuteronomy right now. And we're currently in Deuteronomy 24, and we'll be beginning our specific discussion with verse 14 once I finish this intro. One of the questions that's come up in the course of our discussion of the last sections of Deuteronomy in the last couple of episodes is the boundary point of the stopping point between two different sections of Deuteronomy. We're all operating on the belief that a large section of Deuteronomy is organized by the 10 words. The 10 words are repeated in Deuteronomy 5, and then from chapter 6, a bit more from part of chapter 5 on to chapter 26, it's largely organized by those 10 words. And we had been working in the eighth word section, that is, thou shalt not steal. My claim is that the eighth word section continues on through chapter 24 to the end of chapter 24. James Jordan suggests that we start the ninth word section with verse 8 of chapter 24, which is reference to leprosy and refers to Miriam and Miriam's slander against Moses. And that introduces the issues surrounding the ninth word. We can pick that up in a second, but I wanted to highlight something that I've mentioned before. The section we're going to be looking at in the previous, much of the previous couple of sections we've looked at have to do with Israel's economic life, relations between creditors and borrowers, relations between employers and employees, as we'll see in this case, and also the use of land and property in ways that benefit the vulnerable and the poor within Israel. We looked at the practice of scrumping, which comes up at the end of chapter 23, and we'll be looking at the gleaning laws at the end of chapter 24, either in this episode or the next episode. And I suggested the last episode or a couple episodes ago that what we have in Deuteronomy is an economy that's embedded. I use the term from Karl Polanyi, not just embedded in social relations, although I think that's true, that economic relations are not purely economic relations. They're not merely transactional relations. But when you're going to the market, you're dealing with brothers and with foreigners, and the rules are somewhat different depending on what kind of person you're dealing with. So that's an indication of what Polanyi would call an embedded economy, where economic relations are embedded in social relations and not anonymous transactions in an anonymous market. But the more particular thing I've emphasized is the fact that this is the economic life of Israel is embedded within a relationship with Yahweh. Yahweh is the overseer of the economy. If there's an invisible hand in Israel's economy, it's the invisible hand of Yahweh, the just God who punishes and rewards and gives to men according to their deeds. And one of the indications of that is the way that Moses talks about the access that oppressed people have, people are abused, the access that they have to the Lord. If you do right by the debtor and you don't take his pledge and overnight, then he will bless you and the Lord will hear that blessing and he will bless you. Or in the case that we'll be looking at in just a moment, a man who doesn't receive his wages on the day that he's labored, he cries out to the Lord and the Lord hears him. And that's a danger to you because you've abused somebody that's under Yahweh's protection. Yahweh is, he scrutinizes what's happening in the transactions of Israel. And I think I just wanted to highlight one small indicator of that. I think there's a couple of references here to the going down of the sun, which I think we should think of not just in terms of the natural cycles of day and night, but rather also in terms of liturgical cycles. So verse 13, you're talking about the poor man. A poor man who receives a loan, the lender, the creditor, is not allowed to keep the pledge overnight. But when the sun goes down, or literally when the sun enters, the image seems to be that not that the sun disappears, but the sun enters into his chamber so that he can he can rest and come back the next day. That seems to be the portrait, the picture of the disappearance of the sun at night. But when the sun enters, then you shall return the pledge to him. So you say that's at the end of the day, as you return the pledge. That same phrase is used in verse 15. Here it's talking about paying wages. Before the sun enters, you pay the wages of your hired man. That's a natural cycle, obviously, but there's also a liturgical cycle that overlaps that in Israel. So every sunrise, the priests at the tabernacle, later at the temple, are going to offer the daily sacrifice, the tamid, and that smoke is going to go up before the Lord, and the Lord is going to receive it, and it's going to be a soothing aroma in his nostrils. It's kind of a smoke signal to the Lord, pay attention to Israel this day. And then the end of the day, they offer another offering, the evening sacrifice that ascends to the Lord and has a similar kind of effect. It catches the Lord's attention. And the idea that the sun enters or the sun goes down, that's connected in various places with the evening offering. The evening offering of Passover, the same phrase is used in Deuteronomy 16. In Deuteronomy 16, at evening, according to the entering of the sun, would be a very literal way to translate the phrase in Deuteronomy 16:6. Sundown is the time when your purification happens. So those are all connected not only with the cycles of day and night, but also with the liturgical cycle of a morning and evening offerings. And I think that's another indicator of this kind of embeddedness of Israel's economic life within a liturgical structure. The offerings morning and evening are the clocks, the liturgical clocks of Israel's life. Then they have other festivities, of course, that mark out different periods of time within the year, but their days are marked liturgically by the clock of morning and evening offerings. And those morning and evening offerings are connected with the prayers that, to quote King Lear, the poor naked wretches within Israel are praying to the Lord, whether prayers of blessing to those who have treated them fairly and justly, or prayers of complaint before the Lord. Those are bound up or mingled with the offering, the smoke that arises to the Lord, and the Lord responds to that. So again, I think that's we're not looking at in Deuteronomy, we're not looking at a modern idea that economic life is value neutral, that it's atheological, that it's just a matter of supply and demand and impersonal forces. You're dealing with persons, human persons, who have various kinds of social relations with each other, familial relations with each other, as well as economic relations with each other. And then even more importantly, this whole economic life is played out under the oversight of a just and holy God.
So this is one of the things we see throughout Scripture then, is to say this a little bit differently, Peter, is that the efficacy of the liturgical life of Israel or even the church can't be separated from practical living. You can't come into the tabernacle or temple and expect that your offerings are going to be accepted if you've misbehaved during the day. So if you have been, and excuse my voice here, it's allergy season, but so if you have, as a worshiper, if you have been generous to your neighbor, verses 10 through 13, then that'll be your righteousness before the Lord. If you have oppressed your employees, your hired servants, then he's going to cry out against you. And so there's a sense in which this is a prophetic critique, of course, in the Hebrew scriptures. You can't just count on the temple and the sacrifices. They're intimately bound up with the way you've behaved toward one another.
Yeah, that's really good. And to take it just one step further, this is making a step beyond what the text explicitly says, but I think it's a legitimate move, that the prayers, the blessings, and the curses of the people of the land are taken up and mingled with the smoke that's arising to the Lord. So I'm thinking of the image that we have in Revelation 8, for example, where there it's the incense that's offered along with the prayers of the saints. But if you think of the sacrifices as a way of calling the Lord's attention to Israel, or smoke signals to the God, or the prayers arising along with the smoke, then offering the sacrifices when you're acting unjustly does the opposite of protecting you, because it's actually relaying those complaints up to the Lord.
Yeah, and you are putting on those sacrifices, remember, in an ordinary situation, your tribute offering, your minkah, which is itself an inviting the Lord's evaluation of you, so that the sending up of the offering, the smoke and the minkah, is basically asking the Lord to judge you.
Quick comment just about the general subject matter here. I was looking back over these commandments, and seems to me, I mean, we're in the stealing section here, aren't we? The eighth word. And seems to me that the general thing going on is that there's to be this appropriate balancing of rights. So people have property, and that's to be respected. It's not to be stolen. They have a right to it. But at the same time, that right isn't supposed to trump other people's rights. So here, for instance, if someone's lent something to someone else, they have a right to expect it back. But that doesn't mean that they can just go on to someone else, go on to the borrower's property and claim it back anytime they fancy it. That borrower has a right to their privacy and to their property and so forth. And that strikes me as sort of extending. So people's fields are their property, and so is that field's produce. But a sojourner who's come upon hard times has a right to something from it too. And so while you have a right to harvest, you don't have a unlimited or untrammeled right to do that. It's to respect the rights of the sojourners. Similarly, you know, people that have a right, perhaps even a duty, to punish others. We'll come to that, I think, in the next chapter, who've done wrong. But again, those punished then have a right to be treated still in a humane way. And it just feels to me that that kind of balancing of rights, and actually also with God's rights, I guess, because God's image is in the punished person and God has a right there. But that whole issue of balancing things seems to lie behind a lot of this section.
And the concern that in the administration of justice, that's the image of God in your neighbor is always preserved, is something that we see at several points in the book of Deuteronomy. We have the limitation of stripes, for instance, and the way in which beating the wrongdoer too much in punishment would actually serve to dehumanize him in your eyes. And so there are these humanizing commandments in the administration of law and justice that recognize the way law itself can become a form of injustice if it's untempered by mercy, if there's no sense of the boundaries of that other person that you might trespass upon, they've wronged you. And this, it seems to me, is one of the things that has to bear on the question of where the boundaries are. So if we're thinking about this under the category of the eighth commandment, the concern is very much stealing and managing those sorts of things. On the other hand, if we see this under bearing false witness, we might see it as a matter of the broader concern of the administration of justice, false witness being something that belongs in the context of the court, and false witness against your neighbor being not necessarily just the narrow act of perjuring yourself against someone in order to get your way and to have vengeance upon them or something of that kind, but also using the system of law in a way that is untempered by mercy, in a way that makes that system of law that's supposed to be for the life of Israel something that brings death to people. And at the very heart of it, we can maybe see this as the satanic use of law, the use of law as a means of death, accusation, destruction and condemnation. And the way that a proper use of law, even when it punishes the wrongdoer, is always something that has mercy and a recognition of their humanity and an attempt to restore that and to guard what remains of their dignity.
So is that why there's a prohibition, this guarding of dignity, Alistair, as you put it? There's a prohibition against the lender, against going into the house of the one who he's collecting the pledge from. He needs to stand outside, verse 11. Is this just respecting the borrower's space? Is it respecting his personal property? Would going in after it indicate some sort of aggression? What do you guys think's going on there?
I think within the structure of the commandments, we've already noted the way that there is this movement from the most direct assault upon the human person in murder to these more elaboration of that principle. In, for instance, you're attacking someone directly if you attack their one flesh union with their spouse, or you're attacking someone if you attack their property, or you're attacking someone if you attack their reputation and their honor, or you're attacking someone if you seek to take their place and act in a sort of envy or covetousness. And in all these cases, it's recognition of the movement from the most direct to something that's more elaborate. We thought about this also in the terms of the first three commandments, in the most direct to most, maybe subtle is not the word, but a more elaborate form of idolatry, where you're attacking the Lord's reputation by not bearing his name with honor. And here I think what we're seeing is that same logic, that you may have claims against someone, but recognize dignity of that person, recognize that dignity is something that's embodied in part in their property, their space, that's embodied in part in their reputation, that's embodied in part in their relationships, and show honor to those things as much as you can, even when you're in the process of having, you recognize there is your rightful due that they have not yet given you. Even in that situation, recognize those realities and honor them almost in a pointed way to protect them at point of vulnerability.
Yeah, I think, Jeff, I think what you said is what I would say about that particular rule. You're maintaining the integrity of the man's house, even though he is in a position of subordination. That doesn't mean that you can claim everything that he owns. Verse 11 even suggests that you're remaining outside. It's almost like the creditor is not just forbidden to go in, but he's almost like in a position of standing sentry. I think the verb is standing, right? He's standing outside, Ahmad, yeah. And so it's almost like he's a sentry at the borrower's doorway, not just not going in, but in a sense preventing anyone else. His role is to protect the integrity of the borrower's home and his space. I want to go back to James's comments and just register. I don't have a positive response or alternative that's clearly formulated in my mind, but I wonder about the way that you put it, James. I agree with you about the substance of what you were saying. I wonder if a balancing of rights is the right way to think about it. It does seem like rights language tends to put us it sets up social relations almost in an immediately inherently adversarial kind of relation. I have rights that inherit in me that I protect. You have rights inherent in you, and those rights clash, and we try to negotiate through those rights. I guess one thought I had is a way of alternative way of stating that would be, if you're a property owner in Israel, then you could talk about, yeah, you have a right to that property, but that right itself includes certain responsibilities to the whole of Israel, and particularly, as we'll see in the gleaning laws, to aliens, orphans, and widows who don't have means of sustenance of their own. They don't have property of their own. So it's not that you have rights, they have rights, and those are clashing, but that rights entail certain kinds of responsibilities. And the proper exercise of a right to property involves those kinds of permissions to the poor. So that's a distinction without much difference, but I'm kind of allergic to rights language because it does seem to have this portrait of social life as inherently conflicted.
Well, Peter, and yet still there appears to be at least the temptation for the lender to what can we say, overassert himself or go beyond what is appropriate and right with regard to the debtor. And the same thing in verse 14, there certainly is the temptation for someone who has hired servants to oppress them, by keeping back wages. So these laws do, in fact, limit the one who has authority and has some power from exercising it in illegitimate ways.
Yeah, as I say, I'm maybe making a distinction without much of a difference. And if I had a better alternative way of stating the point, but I think rights language gets into a tangle, particularly if you're defining rights in modern. You know, I think the idea of inherent human rights and the way that in modern thought the inherent human rights have been imperialistic and expansive. So you have an increasing list of inherent human rights that everyone is entitled to, and I guess maybe that's part of what I'm objecting to or cautious of, is the idea that what we're looking at is various forms of entitlement rather than various forms of responsibility, I guess.
Yeah, that's helpful. Maybe we could put it in terms of different levels of obligation then. So I am obliged to keep the Sabbath, let's say, as an Israelite, but if it's the eighth day and I need to have my child circumcised, then that is a higher obligation. And maybe we could cash some of that out in the same way then. So I have I'm trying to think how I can avoid the word rights now. I'm allowed to go and claim back possessions, but I have a higher duty that's to kind of respect my brother and to love my neighbor. And maybe we could cash it out in some of that prioritization.
Yeah. I think part of the issue, and I'm not trying to censor you, James. If you want to use the word rights, we're going to let that through. Brian's not going to bleep those out every time you say the word rights.
Right.
In some settings, you have rights that are part of a constituted kind of legal structure, and that you have certain claims and immunities and entitlements that are exist within a designated legal structure. I think that's the kind of use that you find when rights language is used in medieval political thought. It's rights that are embedded within a particular configuration of social life and of law. I guess I think that would apply to what's happening in Deuteronomy. You could talk about rights because this is within a particular constituted system. I think then the risk or the danger comes when you try to abstract rights and the language of rights from that legal structure, and you have just entitlements and immunities and claims that are free-floating of any particular system of law. And that's part of what I think is problematic about modern rights language. But anyway, we can move on from this. I just wanted to register, and as I said, a certain degree of allergy to that terminology.
I think one of the things that does protect against the rights framework and the way in which that constantly drives a system of competing and contesting rights is the fact that ultimately God is the guarantor of all justice, and there is this higher court of appeal, and that God will act in these sorts of situations. And so even if there is a breakdown of justice on the human level, there is this recourse to divine justice, and also this confidence that God will act ultimately to set things to rights. And that means that there can be a relaxation of some of the anxious and the extreme demands that can arise on the human level that would otherwise lead to a very litigious and grasping society, because you're willing to hand things over to God because ultimately he's the one who brings justice.
Yeah, I think that's a really good, important point, that I think rights language begins in a kind of theistic setting in the medieval political thought. It continues that in some early modern political thought, but it's been detached from that. And I think that's a crucial point. wanted to highlight, move on to talk about a couple of specifics, verses 14 and 15, about hiring servants and paying the servants that you hire. The law is, simply put, is that if you hire someone to work for you, you cannot oppress them. And the particular kind of oppression that's being described is oppression of not paying the wages, and not paying the wages in a timely way. This is a day laborer, and the day laborer is to be given is to be paid and compensated for his labor on the day in which he labors. I think it's also important, verse 14 makes it explicit that this is something that applies both to brothers, fellow Israelites, and also to those who are in the land who are not fellow Israelites. And there are other places where there's a distinction made, and certain kinds of things are permitted to aliens or foreigners and not to Israelites. In this case, this form of oppression of not paying wages is forbidden to Israel, whether they're dealing with fellow Israelites or someone else who's a resident at the land but not an Israelite.
The other fascinating thing about this is verse 15. The reason given here for the employer paying the daily worker his wage quickly is not, to go back a little bit to what we just talked about, it's not because he has a right to it, but because he's poor and he counts on it. The Hebrew is something like he lifts up his soul towards it, or to it, he lifts up his soul, his life. And that's a curious expression, but is there a sense in which the physical life of this poor person depends on getting daily wages? He has to go purchase food or feed his family or whatever. But also, is there this desire that he has to get this, because his earthly existence, maybe even his future, depends on this? So that since he is a daily worker, his entire life is kind of wrapped up in this for now. And if there's going to be any hope of him moving on from this state of affairs, he has to have the assurance of a regular, and trustworthy salary every day. I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with that, but I just found it fascinating that the reason given here is because he lifts up his, or to it, he lifts up his life, his soul.
Yeah, I thought that was a striking phrase too. And just the introduction of soul into this law. And it occurred to me that that's one of the underlying assumptions of a lot of the economic legislation in Deuteronomy, deutereconomics, if we want to call it that. And it is that human beings, and also penal law, everything in Deuteronomy, when you're dealing with other persons, you're dealing with souls. So that you can hire an animal, you can hire a tool, and there are laws that cover those kinds of things. But the hired laborer is a different category of thing that's hired. And he has his own desires, his own soul, and you're supposed to treat him. And there's almost a call to sympathy or empathy or certainly compassion for that hired laborer. You have desires for your wife. Your soul longs for to have its needs fulfilled, as you were saying, Jeff. Your soul longs for good things, and so does the poor man. He's not just a machine that you can hire, but he has his own desires and wants, and you should kind of put yourself in his position and give him what you would want in the same position. So it's a kind of application of the golden rule, in a sense, where you're sympathizing with the person that you're rewarding with payment.
Yes, and it's quite full of Exodus language, isn't it? I think that you made this point last time around, Peter, but the man here is poor. It's a particular word for affliction that occurs quite frequently in the Exodus, and lest he cry out against you to the Lord. So, I mean, a lot of this whole section is predicated, trying to find an example of it now. Verse 18, you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. So just as kind of Israel's cry and affliction resulted in their liberation. Kind of, so these workers now in the context of Israel, if they cry out and if they're afflicted, then the Lord will sort of hear that and visit it against the oppressive Israelites. So there's that sort of, I don't know, possibility of an exodus within Israel nested in this text.
Right. Yeah. So one way to state the exhortation is, employers, don't be Pharaoh, or, you know, your employees will cry out against you and you'll end up like Pharaoh. I wonder if you all have any thoughts about beyond what the text explicitly says, how it might apply to thinking about wages more generally. In Catholic social thought, there's an emphasis on family wage or living wage, that it's just and right for employers to provide a living for their employees, so that you know, an employed husband and father would be able to support his family with the single wage that he receives from his work. And he wouldn't have to scramble for more than one job at a time, or, you know, have his wife have to go to work just to make ends meet. Do you think that this law encourages that kind of thinking? If you think about it, exhorting the employer not to oppress a hired servant. Here it's pay the wages, it's not stating anything about the level of the wages. And presumably he's paying a day's wage for a day's labor. But do you think that this might apply more generally to question of wages?
It's certainly something that's been used by some in the context of Jesus' parable about the paying of the laborers. Think of the famous treatment of these subjects by John Ruskin, Unto This Last, which really takes the words of that parable, that the people who only worked for a few hours were given a full day's wage because that's what they depend upon to feed their families. And by the interaction between the landowner and the laborer, some responsibility incurred for the well-being of that labor that day. And so paying them that full amount that they need, even if they've not worked for the full time, is a way of discharging a responsibility. And also, it seems to me that might miss something of the aspect of grace within this. But it is something that's often been referred back to biblical treatment of economics, whether within the parables or in places like this in Deuteronomy.
Well, the person here is poor, and there's no indication in the text or in other laws in Deuteronomy that it is the employer's responsibility to make him rich or to eliminate his poverty. It's just to give him the just wages that he earned that day for whatever he does. I think one of the problems with the living wage issue is it doesn't take into account the value of the work. And also the fact that in economies such as ours, which is not like Israel, or maybe it was in some sense, there's a lot of mobility, so that wages that you might earn, you know, working at a fast food shop may not be a living wage, but the fact that it's not encourages you to move up, move on, increase your education, gain a different skill. You have family now, you have a wife now, you have children now. You can't be working at McDonald's forever. That kind of mobility, I suspect, is also, you know, the case in a more free culture like Israel as well. So you got to factor in the personal responsibility and the skill set of workers as well. Otherwise, you do something like California just did. This is an interesting question. California just did this week, introduced a $20 minimum wage law for a certain class of businesses in California. I think it was if you had more than 100 establishments or something like that, or maybe 100 employees. But that's all well and good and well-intentioned, but the economic results of that may end up harming more people than it helps.
Right. I mean, that is the the economic issue that comes up with living wage, family wage issues. You know, I think it could distinguish between what's being encouraged here, if anything, to employers on the one hand, and whatever what kind of policy structure you'd want in order to in order to reward work and encourage people to labor and to have a have a decent life. Those are two distinct things. So I was thinking more particularly about what this encourages employers to do. And you could have, I guess one way to state the question is, if you have a small business, you've got 10, 15 employees, to what extent are your decisions about what you're paying the people affected by the fact that you know the family circumstances and the life circumstances of those people? And again, I guess it goes to the issue of considering and treating the hired servant, recognizing him as a brother, not just as a hired servant, but as a brother, and recognizing that he has his heart set on certain things and sympathizing with that. That's the kind of scenario I'm thinking of, not so much policy questions, because you're right, Jeff, that the policy decisions to raise wages often backfire and hurt the people they're supposed to help.
Well, and just quickly, giving him his just wages, depending on the kind of work he did at the end of the day or end of the pay period in modern time, that's one thing. And it's important. But it may be that you know as an employer that this worker, this husband or this wife, this single mother, that this is not everything she needs. And is it going to be? And so I do think that employers ought to take a concern with their employees that they're helping them. And there's all sorts of ways to do that. You know, you got the Chick-fil-A model that basically helps young people with their education, with their training, in all sorts of ways. And I think that's commendable. And there are lots of businesses that do that. But that often means that they're not going to be happy with where they are right now, but you as an employer can still be generous in your help with them. But them not being happy where they are is often a good thing, because that makes them desire what they truly need in order to survive or to feed their family.
One thing that I think can cause problems is the way in which sort of practices that are encouraged here, which are not strictly speaking rights or entitlements, that's not really what we're dealing with here, but there's a sense of rest that's taking place. That, for instance, in Jesus' parable, the owner of the land does not, the workers do not have a straightforward claim on a full day's wage. And if we were to convert that into the framework of rights and entitlement, it would, first of all, remove the element of grace, but it would also set things in competition and rivalry again. And there's something of the element of grace that, when it's not framed within the structure of law, where this person is required as the employer to pay this particular amount or to give this specific entitlement, or it's provided by the state, etc., something, the true character of the society that this is encouraging shines forth, that it's not a society ultimately that comes down to rights and entitlements. Everyone feels themselves to be a recipient of grace, who must in turn act in grace towards their neighbor. And that, I don't think that is something that can become that can be expressed purely within the structure of law. Many of the struggles that we have within modern societies in providing for people out of structured entitlements and rights and certain types of legislation, whereas I think they're good in principle to a certain degree, I think as they lose that element of grace, they undermine the true nature of a society that this text and other texts like it are advocating. It seems to the socialist model, instance, I think there are elements in which it protects from abuse and predation of people who have economic power upon those who lack it. But you can't ultimately found a gracious society upon law. There has to be something beyond.
Yeah, that's very helpful, Alistair. And it seems, to me at least, to be reflected in the text. I mean, the tale of verse 13, it shall be righteousness for you before the Lord, will obviously remind the Christian reader of Abraham, who believed and it was credited to him as righteousness. And I think you could legitimately then see this as kind of an extension of what the believing and the godly person will do, that this isn't sort of done out of law, and the motive isn't even so that the society will run better, because that's how societies get on. You know, rather it's so that you will be righteous before the Lord. And then in verse, 19, you're to make these provisions when you harvest your field, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. So there is that deeper rationale, isn't there, for all these commandments?
Well, let's move on to verse 16. Verse 16 is something of an anomaly here, and I think it seems like an anomaly whether we're thinking of this as eighth word or ninth word legislation. It doesn't have to do with pledges and loans, as some of the previous verses have done, or payment of wages, as the next previous two verses, but with punishments. Fathers are not to be put to death for their sons, nor sons for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. And the one thought I had about trying to connect them is to recognize the flexibility of in the Bible, and in our parlance, inspired partly by the Bible, the flexibility of the idea of wages. And the Bible uses wages not only to describe payment for services rendered, as it does in verses 14 and 15 and elsewhere, but also uses the same term to describe reward more generally. I think that Boaz wishes that the Lord will pay or give Ruth her deserved wage for her kindness to Naomi. And of course, Paul talks about the wages of sin is death, and Proverbs sometimes talk about what's given to the righteous and the wicked in terms of wages. So that was my thought for connecting this with the previous section, that it's just as you give what's due to the person who's working, so judges, being addressed in verse 16, have to give what's due to the person and not punish somebody who's closely related to the offender for the offender's sins.
So part of the connection, Peter, also is just the flexibility of fathers, of the notion of fathers. Fathers are not just biological fathers, but also those in authority, employers. And that's also a common way in which fathers is used in Scripture.
Yeah, that's helpful. You're putting us back into a kind of fifth word territory, but that's it's a general theme. We saw that when we looked at the fifth word section of Deuteronomy, that most of the fifth word section doesn't have to do with fathers, literal fathers, but rather with other sorts of authority figures.
So is this law about capital punishment, or can we extend it? Is this fathers shall not be punished because of their children, or is this just about, you know, putting someone to death?
Yeah, I was wondering a similar thing. I mean, there's a slightly abrupt jump, isn't there? And you wonder to what extent this was done in Israel or any society and needed to be prescribed. And then standing in the background of some of it, to my mind, is the incident with Saul's sons. Aren't they effectively put to death because of Saul's sin? And it seems as if the Lord accepts that to some extent as a offering. Kind of wrath is turned away. I think it might use the verb atone there. So, I mean, yeah, I'm just sort of raising them as issues, really.
In the case of Saul's sons and other cases like the killing of Canaanites, wonder whether there's a sort of more absolute divine justice that is envisaged in situations where the consequences of father's sins can fall upon their children. And there's maybe a limitation upon what human justice can do. Human justice cannot claim to exercise the absolute authority of the ban, for instance. It may be authorized under extraordinary circumstances in holy war, but this is not the way that human justice will normally function. I think the other thing in the background of this, perhaps, is within a more familiar society, you can imagine vendettas and the sort of rivalries and antagonisms between two families spiraling into killing of family members in reciprocal acts of vengeance. And that sort of logic is put to a halt by this principle of justice. And it's, again, an approach to justice that takes into human hands the more radical rooting out of sin, the more radical punishment that belongs to God alone in these circumstances, or at least that's what I wonder.
Yeah, Christopher Wright says something similar to that in his commentary and suggests that if you have somebody who's a known criminal who's been executed, then there's not necessarily a put to death sons for their father's sins, but the sons are blamed, the sons are derided, the sons are marginalized and excluded because of their father's sins. And he suggests that this is another, I think this is part of the way he links it with the other surrounding laws. It's another case of protecting those who are vulnerable. If you have a criminal in the family, then you're tainted by that, and this is a warning against that extension of the criminality to the whole family.
At the same time, if there is complicity, then there could be punishment. So I mean, this is a rather stark and kind of absolute statement here, but I suspect that I'm quite sure that judges and priests, when they got together to adjudicate matters like this, if children were part of the plot, part of the conspiracy to murder or whatever, then they might be punished. But not just because they're children. Interesting case, you guys probably have seen this just this past week again, where that Michigan boy, Ethan Crumbly, 15 years old, and goes in and shoots up the high school at Oxford High School. And of course, he's charged and gets, I think two life sentences without parole or something like that. But then his mother was also charged and sentenced, and his father as well. So both his father and mother are charged for his crime. And presumably, just looking at the news articles on this, it seems as if they had some complicity. They had some knowledge. They failed to restrain him. They gave him access, unrestricted access, apparently, to the firearm that they had bought. And that's why I say, I mean, sometimes fathers will be punished, and punishment will be meted out to fathers because of the sin of their children if they were involved, or if they failed on some really fundamental level to restrain or to guide or their children in some way.
On that front, I wonder whether we should relate this to the other commandments concerning the person within your family who's leading people into idolatry, or the rebellious son. There is a sort of radical form of justice that can be exercised within the family where, without pity, that person is put to death on account of their sin, even though they're your close kin. And so that radical principle of justice is the flip side of this principle of the restriction of judgment for person to person, and there's no transition of guilt from one person to another automatically. Rather, because there is this radical principle of justice, the sword within the family, that means that you can exercise this principle of curtailing and responsibility for the son's sins and not transmitting them to the father or vice versa.
Yeah, I'm not at all sure about this, but I mean, just looking at the context, you've got obviously someone who's pledged his cloak and he needs it in verse 13, 14, 15, hired workers, not just any old hired worker, but who is explicitly poor and needy. You know, then we've got this verse 16 commandment, and then straight afterwards, it's about not perverting the justice due to the sojourner, fatherless, etc. It all seems to be to do with the poor, the vulnerable, the disadvantaged. And I wonder if a reading of it, I'm not saying like the only one, but could be that there's not to be a punishment of sons as a result of father's debts and poverty and so forth. I mean, we are in societies these days where there can be kind of multi-generational poverty, sort of debts passed down and all that kind of thing. And I wonder if that could be a kind of a contextual application of it. I'm not certain, but...
So not being put to death literally by some kind of capital punishment, but deprived of the means of life because of their father's sins.
Yeah, maybe. I would have that in addition to the literal sense of it, yeah.
A couple of thoughts on some of the discussion that's been going on. To Jeff's question, I think the biblical example of what you're talking about is Achan, because Achan is stoned because he stole things that belonged to Yahweh from Jericho. But his family is also stoned with him. And although it doesn't explicitly say this, I think the inference that we're to draw is he hid these stolen items in his own tent. Is he going to be able to do that without the complicity of everyone around him? And I think that's an example where we do have a whole family put to death, but it's because they've been involved and they're part of the conspiracy, at least the conspiracy, the cover up. And I think the other thing I wanted to bring up was the obvious apparent counter or tension within the law between the second word, which says that the God visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations, in contrast to this kind of rule in Deuteronomy 24:16, or in contrast to Ezekiel 18, which explicitly says that sons are not to be punished for their fathers or fathers for their sons, but each man is to stand for his own righteousness or his own wickedness. And Ezekiel 18 elaborates at length on that principle. I mean, I think the way I'd resolve that apparent tension would be to say this. I'm curious if you think this is along the right lines. There are intergenerational consequences for the sins of previous generations. The Bible starts with that. The Bible starts with Adam sinning. But when you get to Cain and Abel are also outside of Eden. They're not allowed to go back in just because they're a new generation. The sins of Adam, the sin of Adam passes on, and they're just because of the nature of time, something done cannot be undone. And so if a father is wicked, then he puts his children in a certain set of circumstances that are passed on to them, because despite the fact that they haven't committed the wickedness that he has. So I think that's on the one hand, there's a kind of intergenerational consequences of sin, but that's not, I'm borrowing somewhat from what Alistair said, that's not to be instituted in penal law, that penal law is to operate by a principle of individual responsibility. Those who have committed a crime pay for their crime. And there's almost a kind of renunciation of family members. I think this is also linked to what Alistair was saying, there's a renunciation of family member, of family connection that's evident in those earlier laws about family members who are encouraging to idolatry. And there's a similar kind of thing going on here. So in order for a son not to carry on the sin of his father. He has to renounce his father's sin, and the father has to renounce the sin of his son. So there's a kind of breach with the family relation that is necessary for a righteous son to not continue his father's example, or for a father not to approve of his son's wickedness.
I think in the case of Ezekiel 18, it's important to read that within the broader context of the prophecy. The popular saying that's being responded to is the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth set on edge. The idea being almost a denial of responsibility. You're suffering for the sins of your fathers. And part of the point, I think, of Ezekiel 18 is that it is not just a theoretical case. It's referring to a specific line, and it's the Davidic line. Josiah is the good king at the start of it, then Jehoiakim's the bad king, then Jehoiakim is the bad king, and then Jehoiakim is the third king in exile, and the verdict is still out on him. He could go either way, and he's not doomed as a result of what his fathers have done. Obviously, he's suffering the consequences of a sinful line of behavior, but he can be, as he is, raised up even in the place of his exile, and there could be a turning around, as we see later on in history. And so the sense that the sins of our fathers doom us is resisted in Ezekiel 18. I don't think it's this innovation of principle that some have suggested it is. Certainly, I don't think it's that. But nor do I think it's straightforward odds with Deuteronomy 24 either. It's referring to a very specific context, and it's against the backdrop of a particular line of Davidic kings and dealing with the sense of absolution that people have. It's not our fault. We're just suffering on account of the people's sins. And maybe we have no hand in what happens next. If we repent, it's futile. We're doomed. That, I think, is the background of Ezekiel.
Thank you again for enjoying this episode of the Theopolis Podcast. For more information and for more content from Theopolis, you can check us out online at theopolisinstitute.com. We release new articles every Tuesday and Thursday on our blog, so you'll want to make sure to look out for those. You can also find us on Twitter at @_Theopolis and on Facebook if you just search for our name. If you've been helped, sharpened, and encouraged by this podcast, we'd really love it if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review. It just takes a few seconds, and it really will help us along in getting our content in front of new listeners. That's all for now, friends. We really look forward to being with you all again in the next episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening.